Welcome. Welcome to Perimeter Institute's Public Lecture Series. My name is Greg Dick. I am the Senior Director of Public Engagement and Advancement here at Perimeter Institute. Before we begin this evening, in the spirit of respect and reconciliation, we acknowledge that Perimeter Institute is located upon the lands that have been inhabited by Indigenous peoples from the beginning. In particular, we acknowledge the Haldimand Tract, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg, the Attawandran, and the Haudenosaunee peoples. As settlers, we thank all of the generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. We are connected to our collective commitment to make the promise and the challenge of truth and reconciliation real in our communities. Tonight, we offer a pre-taped lecture due to the current lockdown here in Ontario. Thank you so much to the Perimeter's AV staff and especially to our guest speaker for accommodating this taping much earlier than expected. Tonight's lecture continues on the theme of looking outwards to the universe. We are pleased to have with us Dr. Will Percival. Dr. Percival is an associate faculty member here at Perimeter. He is also the director of the Waterloo Center for Astrophysics at the University of Waterloo, where he holds the Mike and Ophelia Lazaridis Distinguished Chair in Astrophysics. Among his many honors, he has received the 2008 Fowler Award of the Royal Astronomical Society, and a Distinguished Scientist Fellowship from the Chinese Academy of Sciences in 2016. As a cosmologist, Dr. Percival works primarily on galaxy surveys, using the positions of galaxies to measure the cosmological expansion rate and the growth of cosmological structure. He is the survey scientist for the Extended Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey, more commonly known as EBOS. He also holds a senior scientific management position with the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument and Euclid Consortium. In tonight's lecture, Dr. Percival will discuss the results of the EBOS survey, how those results allowed the team to create the largest ever three-dimensional map of the universe, and how this research can offer profound insights into the physics of the universe in which we live. Dr. Percival, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. We are really looking forward to it. Over to you.
Thank you. I hope you all enjoy the talk. So thank you very much for joining me tonight. So I'm going to tell you about some of the work I've been doing over the past 5 years now, mapping the universe with EBOS. So EBOS is a galaxy redshift survey. That is, we measure the positions in three dimensions of galaxies in the universe, and we use that in order to understand the universe. I'm a cosmologist, an observational cosmologist, so what I really enjoy is understanding the universe as a whole, the properties of the universe, for example, what is the matter density, how much material is there in the universe, how fast is it currently expanding, how did the universe begin, how will it end, all of these big picture questions. And these, it's really getting the answers to these questions that I like doing with a galaxy survey. So EBOS is just one in a line of galaxy surveys. It's the latest and greatest survey. I'm going to tell you at the end about some of the future surveys that we're going to do. But before I get into EBOS, I want to tell you a little bit about modern cosmology, really set the scene for why we're interested in looking at these galaxies. So here's a schematic diagram of the evolution of the universe as a whole. We know that the universe started in the Big Bang approximately 13.8 billion years ago. You shouldn't think of this as an explosion. Don't have a mental picture of the Big Bang as being an explosion of space expanding into something, because there is no into something to expand into. The Big Bang really is the formation of the universe as a whole. It's the formation of everything there is. And it's an expansion of everything from that point. So we know that shortly after the Big Bang, there was a period which we call inflation, where the expansion of the universe really accelerated. The universe got a lot bigger very, very quickly. And when I say just after the Big Bang, I'm talking about a time period of about 10 to the minus 34 seconds, so really, really just after the Big Bang. Then in the first 3 minutes of the universe, the universe was very hot and dense, and in fact, it was so hot and the pressures were so great that the sort of reactions that normally you only get in a nuclear explosion could happen. And during this period, there was nuclear fission, nuclear fusion could go ahead. And in fact, a lot of the material that was there, it formed protons and neutrons, and then these joined together through fusion to form a certain amount of hydrogen, of helium, as well as the hydrogen. Then over the next 300,000 years, all of the light in the universe was still trapped into in with the material. The material formed a hot plasma, rather like the plasma that you get inside the sun, and the universe was opaque. Radiation couldn't travel through it, light couldn't travel through it. But after about 380,000 years, the universe had cooled and expanded enough that atomic elements could form, the light could go free, it could stream away. And from certain parts of the universe, that light streaming from this surface has just reached us now, and we call it the cosmic microwave background. And we see it very uniformly over the night sky. After this period, the universe was quite boring. We call them the Dark Ages, because apart from this light that was released from the Big Bang, there was no other light. No stars had formed, no galaxies had formed in the universe. The little concentrations of matter, they were still too small, but they gradually grew and gas fell together and stars could form. And at that point, these astronomical objects could emit light, and light went through the universe again. Then gradually these stars formed into concentrations that we call galaxies. The galaxies formed into clusters of galaxies and so on. And we see a wonderful structure in the universe at present day. Now, at this point, at present day, a new interesting phenomenon is happening, and we call that phenomenon dark energy. What's happening is that the expansion of the universe is actually accelerating. The universe is getting bigger and bigger, faster and faster. And you wouldn't expect this if the forces at work in the universe were just gravity acting on the material in the universe. In that case, what was an expansion would come down and start decelerating as the gravity wins out. So we know there has to be something else, some new physics in the universe to cause this accelerated expansion that we see at present day. And we've called that dark energy, but that doesn't mean we understand what it is. So there are, in fact, two unknowns in the universe. As well as this dark energy, there is also dark matter. Whenever we look at any objects, a galaxy, a cluster of galaxies, and so on, we actually find more matter in there than we would expect if we just added up the number of stars there is, the number of gas there is in that object. So if we take a galaxy and we look at the orbital motions of stars around that galaxy, or the orbital motion of gas around that galaxy, we realize that there must be a lot more mass in the galaxy than we can see by adding up the number of stars and the gas in there. When we look at clusters of galaxies, it gets worse. We know we need then this dark matter. It must be present, but we don't know what the form is. And the big key piece of evidence is that when we try to model what's happening in the early universe, we also require that the dominant contribution, the dominant component of matter, does not interact with light. And hence we call it dark matter. So there's something out there that has a gravitational force that resembles that of ordinary matter, of which we're more used to, but it just doesn't interact through the electromagnetic force. It doesn't interact with light. And then, as I say, on present day scales, present day timescales, we see that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. We don't know why that is either. We have a term for it called dark energy. This was just a name. It doesn't convey meaning. But we do have a mathematical model for it. And this model comes from Einstein's field equation. I must say, I have two equations in this talk. This is one. It's perhaps the most famous equation in general relativity. It drives a lot of work in cosmology. And it's Einstein's famous field equation. On the right-hand side, you have what's known as the stress energy tensor. This is the equation form for all of the material in the universe. It tells you what the material is and where it is. And on the left-hand side, you have the Einstein tensor, which is really describes the geometry of the universe. So this equation tells space how to behave given a certain distribution of material in the universe. And in the center, you'll see there's an extra term. Einstein realized that there was a constant he could put in the equations. He was keen on putting it in because he wanted a static universe. And when he found out that the universe was actually expanding, he called it his biggest blunder. But actually, if we put it in but change the sign, we see that we would get a model with an accelerated expansion. And this is our best mathematical model that we have at the moment for dark energy. So together with dark matter and dark energy, we have a standard model for cosmology. This is the second and last equation in my talk. This is the Friedmann equation. It's basically a derived equation from Einstein's field equations. And what it does is to actually tell us how the scale factor of the universe, how the universe is expanding, given the components within it. Omega m here is the matter density, h is the rate at which a, the scale factor, is growing. And you can think of this as just telling us basically how quickly the universe is expanding. This is a very simple equation. It only has a very small number of terms. It's mathematically, therefore, physicists think it's very beautiful. But physically, it's very hard to explain because, as I showed on the previous slide, we don't know what dark matter is. We don't know what dark energy is. We don't know why they have the densities that they do. And if we look at present day, we find that the present day total distribution of energy in the universe, including energy in the form of matter and just energy in any form, 72% of it, so by far the vast majority of it, has to be in the form of dark energy, this lambda causing cosmological acceleration. 23% of it has to be in dark matter. And if we think about the stuff, the material that we're made of, we call it baryonic material, protons, neutrons, and electrons, that makes up less than 5% of the current energy density in the universe. So most of the universe we don't understand physically, although we have mathematical models that work incredibly well to describe it. So just to show you some data on how well these models do work, this is a simple model. It shows a plot of the matter density in the universe against the dark energy density. And each of these shaded regions show us the areas that are allowed by particular experiments, particular measurements that have been made of the universe. We see that CMB is the cosmic microwave background. I'm going to talk about all of these constraints a little bit more in a moment. That gives us a very tight constraint shown here in the orange. Baryon acoustic oscillations, which is one of the main measurements for the EBOS survey, that is shown in the green. And then in blue, we have measurements from supernova. And the key thing is that all three of these observations agree in one small part of this diagram. And that's what we think our universe, that's what we think the parameters of our universe are. The matter density is around 0.3 in these units, and the dark energy density is about 0.7 in these units. So this is now a pretty old plot. It's 10 years old. What I did was take a plot from one of my recent papers and superimpose it and scale it so that the axes lined up. And you can see that all of these contours have shrunk as we have got more and more and better data. Our allowed regions, our allowed cosmological parameters are tighter. They have smaller error bars, but they all match in terms of finding the same point where we have omega m of around 0.3 and omega lambda of around 0.7. Okay, so I'm still not going to get onto the EBOS survey because I want to take a little bit of time to tell you a bit about these other observations that also come and give us this, what we call a concordance cosmological model, that also give us this information about the universe. So first I'm going to talk about the cosmic microwave background. So to understand the cosmic microwave background, you have to go back to this period for the first 400,000 years after the Big Bang. And as I said before, during this time, the universe is opaque to radiation. Basically, you can't, light cannot travel through it. Now, as you look back at distant astronomical objects, you're looking back in time because the light has taken some time from that, basically it's from it being emitted by that distant object to come to us and be observed in our telescopes. And so if you go back far enough, you get very close to when the Big Bang happened. So the Big Bang happened 13.8 billion years. And if that light has been traveling for 13.8 billion years, you think you might be able to see back to the Big Bang. actually, because the universe was opaque the first 400,000 years of the universe, light couldn't travel. We can't see all the way back to the Big Bang. We can only see basically this surface where light was emitted, where light could travel freely in the universe. Rather like when you look at a cloud, you don't see the inside of the cloud, you only see the surface nearest you of the cloud. So when we look back towards the Big Bang, we don't see the Big Bang itself, we just see this point at which light could travel. That light is the light that we can still pick up. It's called the cosmic microwave background light. And because the Big Bang happened everywhere, then we see it everywhere we look, everywhere on the sphere. So here's a picture of the cosmic microwave background. In fact, the cosmic microwave background is very, very uniformly distributed. It has exactly the same temperature. For those that know, it's called the spectrum of light is called a black body spectrum. It has exactly the same temperature everywhere we look, with only very, very small fluctuations. So these are fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. This map is what's called an Atoff projection. If you think about looking at an atlas of the world, quite often they'll have projected the surface of the world into one of these ellipses. This is exactly the same thing, but the ellipse is now an ellipse of every direction looking out on the sphere. And what this ellipse shows is the temperature fluctuations at one part in 100,000 of the cosmic microwave background. So rather than just looking at a map, which to your eye would just be a flat single color, I've taken out, or scientists have taken out, that 100,000 times larger uniform distribution. They've also taken out a dipole distribution, and you're left here with the cosmological fluctuations in temperature. And these indicate different patches of that early universe had slightly different densities, and their distribution and their pattern tell us a lot about the physics that was going on in the early universe. Making these maps is a whole different talk. There's been a sequence of different observations leading to these exquisite, very beautiful maps with different satellite missions. You're best to go outside the Earth's atmosphere in order to avoid water absorption features and problems with that. But there's been this sequence of observations from the over the last 20, 30, 40 years to get to where we are now in terms of these pictures. And they match the distribution of these perturbations in these maps, matches incredibly well this simple model. This is a plot of the data, the best data that we have now, coming from the Planck satellite against the model. You can see a lot of features in the data. They do have error bars. They are showing a lot of physics that was going on in the early universe, and the model fits them incredibly well. And if you parameterize the model and you allow various things, including the matter density, to vary, then you can measure those parameters to very high precision. This gives us incredible information, as I showed before, on the modern cosmology. It doesn't tell us everything because it's a very distant observation. It doesn't tell us a great deal about what's happening closer to the present day. So for that, we need different observations. And before I talk about EBOS, I'll just quickly review supernova. Using supernova was one of the ways in which dark energy was discovered. The idea is that when some stars, binary stars, reach the end of their natural lifetime, a certain sequence of events happen. This sequence of events ends in an explosion. It's an explosion that happens in a very similar way, whatever star is exploding. And it's because matter falls onto that star until it reaches a critical mass. And that critical mass allows this explosion to be calibrated in terms of the brightness that it gives off. So if you can single out this particular type of supernova, you can quite often pick them out using spectra of the supernova, then you can use this as a standard candle. So here's a discovery image of the supernova, just to show you what I'm talking about. This is a distant galaxy. This is a distant galaxy after the supernova has gone off, and there's the supernova in the galaxy. Quite often these can outshine the whole galaxy themselves. And then as soon as you find one of these, you go back into your Atlas of Galaxies and you have a look at that galaxy before the supernova went off, and you find that where the supernova was, there was no discernible individual object or light. So you know that something on a short time scale has happened in that galaxy, and you can go away and get the spectra and find that it's a supernova 1A. You can measure the brightness of it, and then you can use it as a standard candle. By standard candle, what I mean is if you have something of constant brightness and you basically measure that apparent brightness, you measure how bright it seems, but you know that the same amount of light was emitted, then you can get an estimate of the distance. Rather like if you see a car's headlights in the distance, if those lights are dim, you know that the car is far away. If the light is very bright, you know that the car is very near. It's the same thing with these supernova. You can use these as standard candles to get the distances to the galaxies. If you can also measure the velocity, the speed with which the galaxy is moving away from you, then again, you can get cosmological information out. So those were two of the key ways to get cosmological information that have built up this modern concordance cosmological model. What I want to talk about for the rest of this talk is the third pillar of modern cosmology, which is why we have undertaken EBOS. And that is something called Baran Acoustic Oscillations, which we use not as a standard candle, but as a standard ruler. So let's go back to this time just after the Big Bang. And the universe is very hot and dense. It's like a plasma. And we're talking about the first 400,000 years now. Then that plasma can support sound waves. Basically, acoustic waves can propagate through the material. Those sound waves can only travel until the universe has cooled sufficiently that the light breaks free from the material, the bonding between the baryonic material and the light breaks down. We call that decoupling. So what you have, and that's shown in this little animation on the left, if you had a single density spike after the Big Bang in the universe, what you would find is that during this first 400,000 years, an acoustic wave would blow out material, the radiation would drag baryonic material after it, leading to the end result at decoupling of being a spherical shell of baryonic material around your original perturbation. The dark matter is not dragged out because it doesn't interact with the light, so that stays as where the original perturbation was. So we think that in the universe, there isn't just one perturbation. We know there are many different fluctuations in density in the early universe. And so this plot on the right shows a field of different density perturbations around each of which you have this spherical shell blowing out. These small perturbations in the early universe, they accrete material, material falls onto them until they gradually form galaxies and clusters of galaxies. But there is this slight preference in having lumps of material where you have one material at the center of the perturbation and one material in this spherical shell around it. And that slight preference for having these separations of material holds still when we look at galaxies today. So galaxies are concentrations of stars. Each galaxy contains about a billion stars. Here's an image. It's from the Hubble. It's called the Hubble Extreme Deep Field. And most of what you see in this image, in fact, almost all of these blobs are distant galaxies, each one containing upwards of a billion stars, similar to our Milky Way galaxy, which is our own host galaxy. Or at least they will be similar to our own host galaxy after they've evolved from the time in which we've seen them to present day. So these galaxies are not distributed randomly in the universe. They cluster in patterns. And in particular, this Baran acoustic oscillation feature, these acoustic waves in the early universe, means that there is a preferential separation of these galaxies. It's about 500 million light years, but there are more pairs of galaxies separated by 500 million light years than there are by 450 million light years or 550 million light years. So it's by measuring this preferred separation that we can actually have a standard ruler with which to understand and get constraints on the universe. So this is an extreme example. We can't see this feature as clearly as this. We see it statistically, but this shows that what you're really seeing is basically this preference for pairs of galaxies at this separation. So I've got a series of explanatory diagrams now. These are taken from the May issue of Scientific American. I'm not actually sure if it's available to be bought in the shops at the moment, but there's an article in it that I co-wrote on EBOS and on these techniques. And this is a rather a nice sequence of diagrams that I helped put together, basically showing this barren acoustic oscillation feature. So you start with this pattern in space, and the idea is that we want to use this pattern as a standard ruler. Basically now, rather than as we had with the supernova, having a standard candle where we can measure the brightness and then see how far away the supernova was, now we have a standard ruler. We have a feature in the universe that we know what its size is. And if we look at it at different times, then it will subject a different angle to us, and we can see basically how far away it is. To take my analogy with a car, probably slightly too far, now rather than seeing the brightness of the headlights, you're basically seeing how big the car looks in order to estimate how far away it is. So we don't just need this feature, we also need the redshifts of the galaxies. The redshifts of the galaxies, this means basically the recession velocity of the galaxies. Because the universe is expanding, all galaxies are moving away from us. Galaxies further away from us are moving away faster than galaxies nearer by. And this velocity, we call it recession velocity away from us, changes the spectrum of light that we observe from the galaxy. And this is similar to the Doppler shift, similar to the change in sound of an ambulance coming towards you rather than going away. Now we see it with light for these galaxies, and we see a shift in some of the light from these galaxies depending on how fast the galaxies are moving away from us. We call this a redshift because galaxies are moving away, features in the spectrum have moved towards the red end. And it's actually only through the combination of the distance measures from the barren acoustic oscillations together with these redshifts of the galaxies that we can set our cosmological constraints. Basically, we compare our expected distance to the galaxies to the expected redshifts of the galaxies. And it's that combination that depends on the cosmology. So a lot of the effort in using the barren acoustic oscillation technique is built around actually measuring the spectra of galaxies. And so the EBOS survey is one of the surveys that have been designed in order to look at a certain distribution of galaxies and measure redshifts, measure spectrum for as many of those galaxies as we can. Okay, so let's move on. Let's have a look at EBOS in particular. So to start with EBOS, we use the Sloan Telescope. It's a telescope out in New Mexico. And originally, this telescope was fitted with a standard optical camera. It's a multi-wavelength camera shown here at the top left. And this camera was used to take digital images of the night sky. These are those images. We want extragalactic observations, which means we want observations of galaxies other than the Milky Way. Our own Milky Way galaxy acts to sort of like stop us seeing very clearly through our galaxy. And this means that there's a band in the night sky that we can't see very clearly through. And that's basically here. But in the directions away from the plane of the Milky Way, we can make our observations. And so we observe the North Galactic Cap and the South Galactic Cap. These multicolor images, most of the light you see is from distant galaxies. Again, you can easily see that they cluster. There are filaments of galaxies, walls of galaxies, and voids where there are no galaxies. Now, these images are two-dimensional projected images. They're basically what you get if you just look at all the galaxies along the line of sight and you add up all of that light, and that's what falls on your camera. What we really want is to be able to turn this into a three-dimensional map. And for that, we need the spectra to get the redshifts for the galaxies. And to then we have the three-dimensional information using the recession velocities. So the Sloan telescope is designed, as well as taking the imaging data, to also get the spectroscopic data. Here's an image of the Sloan telescope. It's a 2.5 meter diameter primary mirror telescope located at Apache Point Observatory in New Mexico. In terms of modern astronomical professional telescopes, it's quite small. It's only 2.5 meters. Telescopes these days go up to 10 meters, and they're currently building telescopes up to 30 and 40 meters in diameter primary mirrors. The key thing about the Sloan telescope that makes it really unique and really useful, it was unique up until a few weeks ago, but really useful, is the multi-object spectrograph on the back end. So here's a schematic picture of how the spectrograph works. The light here comes in from the top. It falls on a focal plane. At that focal plane, we have an aluminium plate. It is about a meter across. Into that plate are drilled 1,000 holes. And each one of these holes locates the end of a fiber optic cable. That fiber then feeds the light that falls onto that hole through to the spectrographs. Now there are 1,000 holes, 1,000 fibers, 500 go to each of two spectrographs. And there the light is split and it's picked up by cameras decomposed into the spectra. So here it is, here are the spectrographs on the telescope. The telescope is now pointed horizontally away from us. So this is the bottom of the telescope, if you like. The focal plane is here in the center, shown by this black patch. And this is where you would locate the cartridge that would then feed the light to these two spectrographs shown in light green. So during the day, when we're not observing, somebody sits on a stool and plugs 1,000 fibers into 1,000 holes into 8 of these different cartridges, ready for the night's observing. It's not that bad because you don't have to start with fiber number 1 and plug it into hole number 1. You can plug the fibers into any hole, provided you plug all of the holes that are available. So you start at the back and move slowly forwards, just gradually plugging away. And then there's a scanning machine that tells the system, stores a file to say which fiber eventually went into which hole. It basically shines a laser through the fibers to work out which one went into which hole. So that saves a lot of time. But during a day, somebody sits on a stool and plugs 8 of these cartridges, ready for a night's observing. The holes in the plates are drilled by a CNC, a computer controlled drilling machine, based on the imaging maps and the known locations of distant galaxies when the telescope is pointed at a particular patch of the sky. So the nighttime operations, you have 8 cartridges stored here in this rack. You have a trolley. So basically when you're observing through the night, you basically finish an observation, you go out from your warm control room out into the cold night, you get your new cartridge ready, you park the telescope pointed up, you take the cartridge off that just did the last observation, you put another cartridge on, and then you go back into the warmth, you park your previously used cartridge in the rack, you go back into the warmth, you press go on the telescope slews around to the next part of the sky, and starts tracking the sky for the next hour of observations, feeding the light from those distant galaxies through the fibers into the spectrographs. And so every hour we can get about 1,000 observations of different objects. And then gradually over the course of, in this case, 4 years, we built up the sky survey. Each one of these circles marks one pointing of the telescope at one patch of the sky, for which there was one plate designed and plugged, feeding the light from 1,000 objects in one of these small circles through to the spectrographs to measure the spectrum and then get the recession velocities to those distant galaxies and build up the 3D map. Okay, so hopefully that's given you a feel for how the survey is built up. Here are some example spectra of galaxies that we obtained. These are different galaxies. You can see they're not, they have very feature full spectra. There are many emission lines, there are absorption lines, and we know what chemical transitions are going on in stars, many stars, to give us these features. We know what their rest frame wavelengths should be. So looking at the wavelengths that we observe, we can compare them to the rest frame. We can work out how much the light has been shifted, redshifted, and then we can gauge the recession velocities and estimate the distances to these galaxies. And this is the resulting map. Each one of these different bands of different colors gives you a different galaxy population that we targeted for follow-up spectroscopy. This area outside here, there are galaxies here, they're just too faint for us to pick them up with this telescope. This sphere that you see is the edge of the observable universe. This is the last scattering surface from which the cosmic microwave background is emitted. And it doesn't mark the extent of the universe, it just marks the extent of the observable universe. This is the patch that we happen to be in the center of that we can observe because there was a finite time from the Big Bang, and that means there was a finite volume that we can see. And I will talk a little bit more about these inset figures later on. Now, just to give you a three-dimensional feel for these maps, one of my colleagues in Switzerland produced this visualization of these different maps. Two of them were there before EBOS, and then these are the EBOS maps coming in now. And this is it in three dimensions, showing you that really what you are seeing now is a three-dimensional map. It's showing the extent of the galaxy surveys, how much of the universe we can map within that observable horizon, that observable sphere that we can see. Now, the pattern that you can see, these different wedges, they are the 3D projection of those patches that I showed before on the sky. This is just where we pointed the telescope. In fact, this distribution of galaxies carries on in all directions, not in exactly the same way, but with a similar pattern. It just happens that we observe this big patch in the north and this smaller patch in the south. Galaxies that are nearer by are easier to see. They tend to be brighter. We can get the light more easily. Galaxies further out are harder to get, obviously. And in fact, if we go far enough out, we have to pick particularly bright galaxies. We have to choose galaxies that have incredibly strong emission in order to be able to get their redshifts and measure their positions. Okay, so it's a wonderful map, but what I'm interested in is the statistics of the map, not the map itself. And so what we do is actually measure the Baran acoustic oscillation feature in these maps. So we actually measure the size, the projected size of our standard ruler. We do that in a very simple way. What we do is we simply count pairs of galaxies, and we count pairs of galaxies that are separated by a particular separation. Remember that this Baran acoustic oscillation feature that I talked about before said that we expect to have more pairs of galaxies separated by 500 million light years than are separated by 450 million light years or 550 million light years. So all we need to do is to find pairs of galaxies that have these different separations, and we can use that to locate the BAO peak. And in fact, here's a plot of us just doing this. This is for one of the galaxy samples that we observed for EBOS. The y-axis in this plot is just a number of pairs, and the x-axis is just a separation. And this plot shows you that there are more pairs here at a separation of around 500 million light years than there are of separations of smaller or larger extent. And so by seeing what the angle is that's projected by these excess number of pairs, we can actually measure a distance to these galaxies, which coupled with a redshift gives us our cosmological information. So we haven't just done this with one sample. The EBOS survey was designed to measure many different galaxy samples. We measured 2 million galaxies in total, but that was split into different galaxies that were samples at different distances. And from all of them, we were able to pick up the Baran acoustic oscillation feature and show that the basic expansion of the universe over this time period matched very well this standard model that we had previously. Okay, so that was great. The future, as they say, is even brighter because of some experiments that are happening right now or are planned in the next few years that are going to go beyond the legacy of EBOS. So I'm going to take the last 10 minutes now to describe some of those projects. The first, which is really exciting, is the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument. It's exciting because on Monday night was the first observations of the survey as a whole. We started what's called the 1% survey. As its name suggests, it's 1% of the final survey. So DESI is a new experiment. It is a factor of 20 times faster than EBOS was in terms of gathering data. It is on a telescope that is a 4-meter diameter primary mirror rather than a 2.5-meter primary mirror. And consequently, you get a factor of 4 more light coming from the telescope. The instrument has a factor of 5 more fibers, 5,000 fibers rather than 1,000 fibers. And so you can see, hopefully you can all multiply 4 by 5 and figure out that it's 20 times faster than EBOS was. So in 4 years in EBOS, we measured 2 million galaxies. Therefore, in 4 years with DESI, we should expect to get about 40 million galaxies. And that means we can push out to higher redshifts. That means we can push out with a more denser sampling of galaxies, and we can really improve the information we get out from the survey. Here's a picture of the Mayall telescope. Just for reference, this is 18 stories high. It's the same height as an 18-story office building. So bear that in mind when you're looking and getting the perspective of this telescope. As I say, this is a 4-meter class telescope. Modern telescopes go up to 10 meters. So we've had fun over the last few years putting together the hardware for the instrument. We need a big focal plane. We need light to be focused from a number of different directions over a wide area. That means we've had to build, polish to really high precision, large pieces of glass. These are pieces of glass 1 meter across that are used to get an achromatic focusing of the light on the focal plane. There are 6 of these large lenses located in a barrel, and that barrel is being swung around at the top end of a 4-meter telescope, as shown here in the bottom right. This had to be craned up into the telescope. Hopefully this crane gives you more idea of the perspective of what an 18-story high telescope looks like. This is the new top end ring being dropped on, not dropped, carefully placed onto the top of the telescope. This is it arriving in Tucson, Arizona. This is it being shipped out there. So this optical corrector, it focuses the light on this wide field of view. This field of view is basically split into a pizza-like shape. Each one of these slices contains 500 robotically actuated fiber positioners. This is an image of one of those fiber positioners. The fiber end is located at the end here. There are 2 different motors that can basically position the end of this fiber into a patrol radius in the focal plane. The software has been designed such that they don't hit each other, but you can get them reasonably close together. But they obviously have to be placed to very high precision. So gone are the days of drilling holes in plates and plugging them with fibers. Now we've got a robot to do that job, and we're doing it with 5 times more fibers. This is a photo of the actual focal plane that basically sits in the middle of this barrel. The big lenses are down here. They focus the light onto this focal plane. And then this is the back end electronics. The big cables coming out are the fiber optic cables. These are 40 meter long fiber optic cables feeding the light down into a cold room at the bottom of the telescope where the spectrographs are located on 2 benches. There are 10 different spectrographs, like there were 10 petals, each with 500 fibers, basically splitting into 3 different wave bands. So each one of these has a different camera. So there are 10 spectrographs, 3 different wave bands for each. So there are 30 different cameras here getting the light from these galaxies. The exciting thing is that science operations started this very week. On Monday, we took the first observations. In fact, actually, I say the weather was pretty bad on Monday night, but we will carry on basically taking observations through this week, doing the first 1% of the survey. We're doing this as a special case in order to check that all of the operations, all of the targeting algorithms, basically everything's working before we go into routine operations that will then carry on for the next 5 years. So also on the horizon is another mission that I'm involved in. It's called the Euclid Satellite Mission. It is, it's led by the European Space Agency, but has significant Canadian involvement. It's due to launch now. It's due to launch in 2023. It just slipped a little bit because there was a little problem with some of the hardware testing that we're just putting right now. The idea is that from the space base, you don't have to worry about the atmosphere. You don't have to worry about the weather. You don't have to worry about fluctuations. The background light is a lot lower. And consequently, you can make a more uniform survey. You can make a better quality survey. So we're going to observe again. We are limited. We still find it difficult to look through the Milky Way. That ruins a lot of observations. So we only observe in these two patches, basically away from the disk. This is what two patches look like in one of these eight-off projections. I should also say that because it's a space base, we can work in the near infrared and visible wavelengths. We have a far wider dynamic range that we can look at. And this is an artist's impression of what the telescope will look like. It's a panchromatic survey, and rather than using fibers to feed the light into spectrographs, because we're working in space, we have a low background. What we can do is we can put a grism, rather like a prism, slightly different engineering, in the optical path, and we can disperse all of the incident light. So rather than picking off particular galaxies, we basically just put a grism in the path, and then our images is not of point sources of galaxies, but those point sources are replaced by little spectra of galaxies in our images. And that's what's shown here. Each one of these stripes is a spectra corresponding to an image whose light fell on that particular pointing. So this is just a simulation, I should say. Obviously, we haven't launched yet. We are in the final stages of construction. This is the thermal and vibration testing mock-up of the telescope. It's basically what they use to test that during launch no bits fall off. We passed all of those tests. As I say, there's a small problem happening now, which has delayed the launch a little bit, but we are currently working on that and getting excited about launch in only 2 years' time. So the final future project that I want to talk about is actually one that's being led here in Canada. It's the Mauna Kea Spectroscopic Explorer. It's proposed as a replacement for a telescope that currently exists, the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope. And the idea here is to take the next step beyond projects like DESI and propose an instrument now with an 11-meter diameter primary mirror. So not a 4-meter diameter primary mirror, but now 11 meters. This particular proposal doesn't have an increase in the number of fibers, but it has a huge increase in the collecting area from this increase in the mirror size. And what this allows us to do, or will allow us to do, is to go out to even higher redshifts and get more and more data about a larger volume of the universe. Because as you go out to basically more greater distances, you get to see an increasingly large volume of the universe, and that means your statistical precision really improves. I should say that the Mauna Kea Spectroscopic Explorer has many science cases, from observations of stars through to cosmology that I'm interested in, and it would be a sort of general purpose workhorse for astronomers both in Canada and around the world. So I'm keen to see this or something very like it get built very soon. Okay, so I think with all these future and with the wonderful success that EBOS has been, we're going to see that spectroscopic galaxy surveys will remain a pillar of modern cosmology for some time to come. It's going to keep me in work, which is a great thing. Okay, and so finally, I've just got this image. This was again made by some of my colleagues in EPFL in Switzerland, and this is a basically a fly-through of the EBOS galaxies with basically a description. If you're watching this remotely, which I know you are, if you want to pause it, there's a URL down at the bottom there. You can watch this movie in full. It's a really nice fly-through, gives you a real feel for the survey that we've produced and how it fits in with the solar system. This part of the movie here is basically designed to show you how the Milky Way, this is actually the Earth, it flies out from the solar system, it looks at the Milky Way and then goes off to look at these distant galaxies. Okay, so I'm going to pause and end it there. If you want to watch the rest of this movie, you're going to have to go and click on this other link. Okay, thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Will, for sharing your insights and all the work that your team has been doing. That was an incredible journey. We really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us.
Not a problem. Thank you very much. I enjoyed doing it.
All right. Well, that concludes our lecture for this evening. Please join us May 7th for our next public lecture. Details will be available on our website, perimeter.ca, as the date draws closer. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great night. Take care.